Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the farcical referendum underway in eastern Ukraine conducted by the pro-Russian secessionists who are proclaiming themselves leaders of independent republics. We will speak with Mykola Rybchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine, about Ukraine's chances of surviving this period of destabilization by Russia and conducting an election on May the 25th that Putin appears determined to prevent. Then, with much of the world's attention focused on kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls, we will look into a full-page ad in Sunday's New York Times blaming the South Korean president for the botched handling of the rescue attempt to free hundreds of schoolchildren from a sinking ferry and the prolonged and continuing agony of recovering bodies. Sun Yun Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss demonstrations against President Park and scrutiny of South Korea's largest public broadcasting company for its coverage of the tragedy, while investigations continue into the former cult leader turned photographer whose family owns the ferry company. Then finally, we will speak with Jeff Stein, Newsweek's intelligence correspondent, who is a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy, who has a weekly column in the Washington Post, Spy Talk. We will discuss his article at Newsweek, Israel Won't Stop Spying on the U.S., and look into efforts by the U.S. intelligence community to block Israel from joining the visa waiver program on the grounds that it would make it easier for Israeli spies to enter this country. And joining us now is Mykola Rybchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He's a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mykola Rybchuk.
Hello.
So this election underway in the east of Ukraine, which Vladimir Putin suggested was a bad idea, but then the separatists went ahead with it, and a lot of people, including myself, think that that was a bit of theater there. But, I mean, what's happening on the ground is kind of a farce, isn't it? I mean, how can you have an election in the middle of civil unrest? And it looks as though, I mean, the same secessionists and separatists are the ones that are conducting the elections, and nobody knows whether they're really Ukrainians or you know, GRU and Spetsnaz, and the whole thing is looking like a total farce.
Absolutely, of course, it's farcical, and it cannot be qualified even in the opinion survey because, you know, it doesn't meet any criteria. Of course, it's political action. It's an attempt to show that we are the masters here and so on. But probably also it's an attempt to give some more food for Russian propaganda because, you know, it wages real propagandistic war, and they try to use any fact or semi-fact or quasi-fact to instigate, you know, tensions and to provoke some conflict. So, yeah, it's just, you know, political game.
So, in other words, this is all being done for the Russian domestic audience. It reinforces the idea that the Ukrainians in the East all want to join Russia. But I'm not sure that Putin wants the East, does he? He'd like to control and influence events in Ukraine, but I don't think he wants to pay for it, does he? He doesn't want to get stuck with the bills.
Of course. He has got already Crimea, which is a pretty heavy burden for Russian economy because they have to invest a lot of money, and expectations of people are very high there. They would certainly be disappointed. Donbass even more, even heavier burden because it's an industrialized region, but the industry was constructed mostly in the 19th century, and you know, any government would have problems with this region. So I don't think that Putin really intends to take Donbass. Crimea at least has some symbolical meaning, symbolical value for Russians, so it can be used by propaganda. But Donbass doesn't have this value. So I don't think that Putin is going to grab the region, and it would be not so easily, actually, because in the Crimea he had some local support, almost 50% of population supported secession in the Crimea. In Donbass, these figures are much lower. You know, it's like 25-30% who would like to join Russia, so it cannot be called popular support. Moreover, there is significant number of people who would like to fight, and I have some recent opinion surveys, and they say that it's almost the equal number. There are 10-12% of respondents who say that they would greet Russian troops in Donbass, but also 10-12% who say that would fight them with arms. Of course, great majority would sit on the fence. This is probably the main reason why terrorists operate relatively freely in Donbass, because most people prefer to stay at home. They don't meet many resistance. Well, the authorities try to fight them, but they very skillfully use civilians. So it's not so easy for Ukrainian forces to curb this uprising. Maybe if they use some methods as were used by Russian in Chechnya, where they didn't care about any casualties among civilians. That's another matter, but since Ukrainian government declared the European provenance, European course, so probably, of course, they should restrain themselves with European rules of game, and it's really a complicated issue, especially if you have a completely destroyed institution, destroyed military, destroyed police and security services. It's big task today to rebuild institutions.
So what do you think then is Putin's long game? Because he clearly, I think he's following Mao Zedong's dictum, which is it's better to have hegemony without responsibility. In other words, to be able to influence events in neighboring countries without being responsible to subsidize them. And he also doesn't want this May the 25th election to take place, surely, because that will legitimize his government that's very weak at the moment. But do you have a sense of, obviously it's been a tremendous boost for him in popular support, and he's been able to use that popular support to turn back the clock and take over the internet and the media, which he already controlled. But now he has complete, total propaganda control now over Russia and over the judiciary, and the opposition has all but been cowed into silence. And those that are brave enough to speak up would be arrested and languish in jail forever. So it's been really a big win for him on the domestic front, but he's nevertheless riding this tiger, isn't he?
Yes, of course, Putin would like to have Ukraine as a satellite state, something like Belarus, or preferably even like Chechnya with Kadyrov, with some tough guy who can keep everything under control and to be quite loyal to Mr. Putin, but it's very unlikely to do in Ukraine. So my feeling, my prediction is that Putin would try to sabotage any reforms in Ukraine, to keep this country in a sort of limbo, to prevent it, moving in any direction, actually moving westward. Because the main threat for Putinism is actually, European modernized democratic Ukraine. It's really deadly, maybe deadly blow for Putinism. So of course the main strategy is to keep the country on the hook, so to say, to prevent any serious investment in the country, to prevent economic reforms. I don't think that he would succeed in long run, but of course it may delay significantly Ukrainian reforms and Ukrainian development. I'm rather reluctant to use this term about legitimacy. Ukraine government is pretty legitimate because it was formed by the parliament, and parliament is quite legitimate body. It was elected 2 years ago and consists of different parties and represent different regions. And by the way, the government got more than 2/3 of support from MPs. It was supported by virtually all the factions except for the communists. So it got constitutional support in the parliament. So it's pretty you know, legitimate government. It's much more legitimate than the government in Russia, which was, you know, they don't have any free and fair elections and so on. The only problem is that, of course, we don't have a president. We have a head of the parliament who fulfills duties of the president. He's interim president, but basically he's head of the parliament. He's just a speaker of the parliament. And because of this, because of this constitutional restraints, we don't have real cabinet minister. We have only interim cabinet of minister. All of them are acting ministers. You know, that's probably the problem. But it doesn't mean that they are legitimate in any way. You know, they did not come to power by some, you know, coup d'etat, as Russian propaganda claims. Because, you know, there was revolution in Kyiv, but all this revolution was eventually channeled from the street to the parliament. And I believe this is the main success of the revolution, that it was not, you know, the power was transferred to the parliament, to legitimate body. So this is okay. And, you know, today I see in Ukraine very strong commitment of the people to hold elections within one round. I notice very strong mobilization. People understand that they should not give Putin and to give Russians any chance to sabotage elections. Because, you know, if we have second round in 3 weeks, it may be a good time for Russia to prepare some more provocations, some more, you know, subversive acts. More than 80% of Ukrainians today declare their will to vote, and probably they would vote for the leader who is leading the elections, just, you know, in order to have the president as soon as possible.
Again, I'm speaking with Mykola Rybchuk, who is a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He's a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. So you've corrected me. It's not an illegitimate government in Ukraine and Kyiv so much as it's certainly a weak government. And isn't the problem that Ukraine has is that it's been so infiltrated by the Russian security people at every level, the police, the intelligence people, and that's going to be a real challenge, isn't it, for the Ukrainians to both have an election that's not sabotaged and to build a military and a police force that's not corrupt. And I guess the most important point is, which is the one I'd like you to address first, is what about these so-called fascist elements that Russia's made a lot of propaganda out of, but there are basic questions to be asked there, and a lot of people in the West are very concerned about some of these right front people. So how is that going to be handled? Because it certainly hasn't been handled so far.
Well, you know, the power of propaganda is just, you know, power, crude power. Propaganda is not built on any, you know, facts, on any arguments. It's built upon simple repetition of some the most stupid things. And if you repeat something, you know, 100 times, you know, many people would think, well, maybe it's not 100% true, but maybe 50%, maybe 5%, but still there should be. Maybe there is at least one fascist in the government. I can assure you that there is not a single fascist in Ukraine government. It's absolutely a complete lie. There are two members or three members of the radical of far-right party called Svoboda. Yes, but such parties, you know, exist in all European countries, and they are registered by the Ministry of Justice. They operate within the law, and probably you remember there was a party like this in Austria, and nothing happened. You know, Austria was not expelled from the European Union, and there was a government like this in Poland, and you remember the Kaczynski brothers. It's a huge exaggeration to call such a party, you know, fascist party. Yes, it's a nationalistic party. It's a party which is has its model is Israel. Yes, you may be surprised, but they all the time they declare that, you know, we would like Ukraine to be like Israel. They mean, you know, sort of national democracy. to preserve Ukraine character of the state, not to let it dissolve. This is only actually, you know, nationalistic, the main nationalistic feature of this party. So, but you know, it doesn't mean that it is fascist, you know. And even moreover, you know, about officials who are in the government, because they are old bureaucrats who, for various reasons, joined Svoboda Party, and they were promoted by Svoboda to the government. But you know, three persons probably do not make significant you know, influence in the government. The government consists mostly of technocratic people. Some of them are Russians, some of them are Jews, many of them are Russian-speaking, like Minister of Interior, or actually Interim President. He's a Russian-speaking Ukrainian. So, you know, I really depressed to comment all these propagandistic things. You know, it's not serious.
Well, but it is something that, of course, Russia's been beating the drum on. And to the issue of how infiltrated the police are, the police are very corrupt. I mean, isn't that the problem? You had a corrupt leadership under Yanukovych, and the earlier flirtations with the Western democracy, the leaders were equally corrupt and not quite as greedy as Yanukovych and his sons. But still, could you address that issue?
Oh, yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. Ukrainian institutions have been very weak all the time, and corruption was widespread. Not as rampant, of course, as within the past years, because it was not corruption under Yanukovych. It was state capture. It's something different. Yes, but corruption is a huge problem, and now we have, I believe, we have a very good chance to clean up the institutions. So, you know, I try to find some silver lining, some, you know, blessing under disguise in this situation, and maybe it's not so bad that Yanukovych completely destroyed all these weak institutions. So maybe there is no need to rebuild them, but just to build new institutions, especially, you know, police. So, and of course, court system needs to be reformed. I feel that Ukraine has a good chance because, first of all, we have more or less, I believe, decent people in the government. Personally, I trust the Prime Minister very much, and I hope that I don't know all of his people in the government, but probably they are like him. Also, even more important that today we have civil society which drew some lessons from past mistakes, because, you know, after the Orange Revolution, Ukrainian society relaxed too fast and did not control the government, did not force the government to fulfill promises, to deliver, And finally, I feel also that government is closely scrutinized by international donors, because the state coffers are empty. Ukraine got bailout from International Monetary Fund, which is an institution which not only borrows money but also takes care of how this money are spent and what kind of reforms are implemented. So, there is a number of factors which may force the government to carry out much needed reforms finally after, you know, 20 years of hesitation. I understand that it's too late, but, you know, better late than never.
Well, but the report's coming out now, though, that Russia is now moving towards a more economic warfare as opposed to the low-intensity destabilization of the East through the GRU and the Spetsnaz and these sort of local thugs that they've organized. How can Ukraine get around that? They owe, what, $2 billion or something to Russia already for the gas that they've used, and Russia's just going to jack up the price.
Well, first of all, it's difficult to comment all these gas issues because the situation is very murky. As you probably know, all the gas and all the energy trade between Russia and Ukraine was very, very, very murky, very nebulous. And actually, I personally have a very strong suspicion that there was double bookkeeping on both sides, and this is probably the main reason why, despite different quarrels and disputes, they never went to the Stockholm arbitrage. Neither Russia nor Ukraine never appealed to the international court. Which for me is a clear sign that they do not want to reveal their books, the documents. And so, you know, they fight, they quarrel, they, you know, discuss all these issues, but they never go to court. This is, you know, typical quarrels between two gangsters. Now I hope that situation would change, and there are very serious intentions of Ukraine government to go to Stockholm, to Stockholm court. There are many complaints on Ukrainian side because, of course, as you know, Russia uses energy as a weapon and blackmail and both pricing and implementation of different agreements are very arbitrary on the Russian side. So Ukraine has good chances to fight on this ground. But also, as you probably know, Ukraine has its own gas, which is pretty sufficient for at least for households. Well, not for industry, but for households is okay. And Ukraine has good prospects for substitution of this energy by coal, by electric energy. Ukraine is one of major exporters of electricity in Europe. But of course, the main thing, main goal for Ukraine is to diminish consumption of gas, of energy in industry, because Ukrainian industry is terribly energy consuming. So this is also what I call, you know, blessing in disguise, because Ukraine would be forced finally to implement some saving energy measures. Ukraine is not actually, you know, as poor a country as many people believe. It's a pretty rich country, and it could be self-sufficient, at least, you know, in production of food. It's also one of international exporters. At least there would be no hunger in Ukraine, this I can assure you. But of course, reforms are much needed, and of course some austerity measures are needed. But, you know, I strongly believe that even if the government manages to close all these channels through which money are stolen, budget is channeled to offshores, it would be enough to keep budget more or less balanced and to pay the bills to Russia, but at the same time to look for alternative sources of energy, alternative sources of supply.
Well, just in closing, Mykola Rabchuk, in this upcoming May the 25th elections, what are the Party of Regions, which is the party that Yanukovych belonged to, and it gets most of its support from the East, from the East where all of this phony election is taking place over this weekend, this referendum. Will the Party of Regions participate in the May 25th elections?
So far it participates, yes. They nominated their own candidate, Mr. Dobkin, from Kharkiv. And also there is a number of other candidates who could be considered as representatives of the region. Probably the most popular of them is former banker Serhiy Tyhybko. I'm really surprised why he was not nominated by the Party of Regions as a candidate, because he would have much better chances to run than Mr. Dobkin. He's much more popular. I feel that there are some, you know, internal disputes and tensions with the party. Probably Mr. Tyhybko is not as, you know, as manageable as Mr. Dobkin, and this may be the main reason why the oligarchs who finance Party of Regions prefer to bet on Dobkin, not on Tyhybko. Tyhybko is pretty self-sufficient figure. But also I see very positive developments in terms that Tyhybko is going to reestablish his own party, which was created some, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But unfortunately, he joined the Party of Regions after Yanukovych's victory, party called Strong Ukraine. I believe, you know, such a development might be very important because this would introduce real pluralism in the eastern regions of Ukraine. Because so far we have had a pluralistic system only in central and western Ukraine, where different parties competed among themselves, but not in the southeast, where power was completely monopolized by the Party of Regions and their satellites, Communist Party, which is not actually a party, it's just simply a puppet structure. So, you know, this pluralism which would emerge in southeast of Ukraine would be very significant development, I believe, because in this case we would have more or less pluralistic system all over the country, and we would have also possibility for different coalitions in Ukraine. So we have to destroy this bipolar system, which of course contributes to various splits in Ukraine. So far as far as I know, Party of Regions is not is participating in elections and is not going to sabotage it. Probably they understand that, you know, such a move would be destructive, and such a move, of course, would be used by external forces, by Russian government to increase pressure on Russia and to also to deepen the split within the Ukraine regions and so on. So I hope that they would continue this responsible behavior.
Well, Mykhailo Rabchuk, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mykhailo Rabchuk, who's a senior research fellow at the Ukrainian Center for Cultural Studies in Kyiv and co-founder and member of the editorial board of Kritika, a leading Ukrainian intellectual magazine. He's a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into growing outrage in South Korea over the government's mishandling of the sinking of the ferry and investigations into the former cult leader turned photographer whose family owns the ferry company.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in? First I
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sung Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University and a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung Yoon Lee.
Hello.
So there's a full-page ad in Sunday's New York Times by I'm not sure who's behind it and how accurate the information is in it, but it's a fairly stinging attack against the president of South Korea, who herself is somewhat under siege. The families of the parents of the high school students that were killed in this ferry disaster have been demonstrating in front of the Blue House, the residency, and there's also been calls for the government to dismiss the top news editor at KBS, which is South Korea's largest public broadcasting company. So let's begin with the ad in the full page ad in the New York Times. Who's behind it, and how accurate are the charges made against the President Park?
Well, maybe it's helpful, if I may, to just address the background behind this ad. The ferry disaster, the ferry that capsized off the coast of the Korean Peninsula in mid-April, has led to really a lot of anger and anguish on the part of South Koreans. South Koreans are very sensitive about man-made disasters, how they are seen by the outside world. With rapid economic development under its belt, South Korea as a nation, as a people, are very proud. And this is considered national shame, the fact that the captain of the ship and the crew were the first to abandon the hundreds of passengers and the ship, that there was incompetence and cowardice, and the fact that you have 300 or more victims once the ship capsized. We know that none was saved thereafter. So the entire nation has been sort of suffering, undergoing a paroxysm of anger and anguish and shame. And the mood in South Korea is such that the entertainment industry is really reeling from this. It's considered impolite, or even been a ban to cheer loudly in baseball stadiums. Comedy programs have been cut back. It's considered very improper if you are laughing, if you are happy, if you are playing golf. So this is the basic background behind people who have volunteered, donated, gave their own money to be able to place an ad in the New York Times, primarily to criticize the Park government. I think the charges are misleading in many ways, even unfounded. The charge that the Park government has been trying to censor media reporting, if that's indeed true, they've not been doing a very good job, because the conservative, the liberal daily newspapers in South Korea are full of articles really criticizing the government's handling of this disaster.
But in terms of the government, it's not control, but the public broadcasting system, which is the largest television network, I believe, in South Korea, there have been calls for the news director to be fired. Apparently he made some insensitive remarks. Where does that stand?
Well, those insensitive remarks he made in public to his junior colleagues, basically saying that 300 victims in the grand scheme of things is, we have to put that in context. We have tens of thousands of deaths from car accidents every year. So, yes, the remarks were insensitive, inappropriate, but probably not really they didn't deserve the kind of public opprobrium and political movement which has led to his downfall. But people are very sensitive and overreacting to any perceived disrespect.
Well, of course, the whole world and the First Lady of the United States is now joining in on this Twitter campaign to free the schoolgirls in Nigeria. And these are school children in South Korea who were drowned in the most callous way, abandoned, literally, and 31 bodies still remain missing. So obviously there's no comparison between these tragedies, but in terms of one getting the headlines and the other one receding from the headlines, I take it in South Korea that is not the case. This is still something that's got the whole country riveted.
Absolutely, riveted is the right word. The entire nation is fixated on this issue. And the fact that there is still, we are still long ways from any kind of closure. As you say, over 30 bodies, persons still unaccounted for, of course, presumed to be dead. The fact that you have so many hundreds of school children, high school students, who are primarily victims in this case, and the fact that, yes, there was a lot of incompetence and cowardice and criminal neglect on the part of the captain and the crew makes for really a politically explosive event in the lead up to South Korea's by-elections, local elections, which are coming up in early June.
So again, I'm speaking with Sung Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University and a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. But the owner of this ferry company, which is run by his sons, is an extraordinarily it's a story you could barely imagine, that this fellow, Mr. Yu, was a a leading member of the Evangelical Baptist Church of Korea, which was founded by his father-in-law. He spent 4 years in prison in the 1990s for defrauding his church members shaking them down to expand his business. He was also investigated in the mass suicide of 32 cult church members who were found dead, bound and hanged in the ceiling of a factory restaurant in 1987. And now he's apparently become a photographer. And the authorities have just arrested the head of one of his front groups on charges of squandering corporate funds for buying millions of dollars worth of Mr. Yu's photographs way above market value. And, of course, these photographs apparently, which are largely of nature scenes, apparently have been shown around the world. So that's a pretty strange twist, is it not?
The plot's been thickening virtually every day. Yes, the owner of this very company is a cultish figure. His brand of Christianity has been branded heterodox. And yet there are a lot of followers. And he's a mysterious, very much self-absorbed, apparently charismatic figure who's been in trouble with the law in the past, as you say. And clearly there has been a lot of wink and nod, lack of oversight between the government authorities, checking up on the condition of the ferry. There's clearly corruption involving government officials as well as employees of this cultish figure. So there's plenty of blame to go around. And what I don't quite get from this New York Times ad is, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. In this case, I think 1,000-word essay, an op-ed, perhaps in the New York Times, instead of spending tens of thousands of dollars in taking out this one-time ad, would have gone much further to make the case, an essay based on logical reasoning and facts, criticizing the government, and especially the owner of this company and the captain and the crew, would have made far more sense than taking out an ad which primarily seeks to humiliate the South Korean government.
Well, this also is in the context of some rather shrill language coming out of North Korea. For the longest time, of course, they've referred to South Korean President Park as a whore and made all kinds of disparaging remarks about her. But now they seem to have gone overboard in their attacks on President Obama, referring to President Obama as a black monkey. Is there anything behind the increasingly shrill nature of North Korean propaganda?
It is quite noteworthy. The invective you just mentioned, nasty black monkey, that actually was the tamer of two articles that came out on the same day denouncing President Obama in shrill racist terms on May 2nd. The other article is just full of vituperation that I'm not sure I'm able to repeat on the radio. We tend to infantilize North Korea, the civilized world, that is. North Korea seems so bizarre and funny at times, their leader, the cultish nature of the leadership and so forth, this young, overly well-nourished leader, 30-year-old leader in North Korea. We tend to sort of dismiss North Korea. If any other country of the world, Iran or Syria or Russia or China, their official news agency called the president of the United States such names, then I think that would merit a lot more attention. But we tend to sort of ignore and dismiss North Korea. But North Korea, we know, especially in the aftermath of the recent release of the UN Commission of Inquiry report on human rights in North Korea, North Korea, we know, is a regime that kills. It's a murderous regime that kills its own people, that has killed hundreds of South Koreans and Americans over the past 60 years. It is a threat to the region and to the free world. So we should take North Korea as it is and see that its hate crimes in speech and in action are something to be reckoned with. We need to deal with North Korea as it is.
And meanwhile, South Korea is not without its problems.
South Korea, has been living under the shadow of North Korea for the past 60 years. At the same time, going back to this ferry incident, South Koreans are very proud of what they have achieved over the past six decades. It's been an unstable peace, but de facto peace we have had in the Korean Peninsula since the end of the Korean War in 1953. Whereas in the 60-year period leading up to the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950, you have four wars in and around the region. And in those 60 years since the end of the war, South Korea has grown to be a thriving democracy and a global leader in automobiles, electronics, and so forth. You know, it is the world's 14th largest economy. South Koreans have a lot to be proud of. So an incident like this, you know, North Korea's provocation, South Koreans have sort of learned to live with or to deny. But an incident like this, where you have a man-made disaster that's claimed hundreds of innocent lives, it rankles the Korean mind, Korean pride.
And just in closing, do you think it's going to affect the presidency of President Park?
I don't think so, because in due course, in another few weeks, South Koreans will find other preoccupations or distractions. In the lead up to the by-elections on June 4th, Park Geun-hye's opponents have an incentive, of course, to wring this issue dry. And North Korea has been, lending a hand, criticizing Park Geun-hye and claiming that, you know, it was her incompetence and cowardice that has led to the death of these hundreds of lives. And but once we have the elections, once we're done with the elections, I think this issue will probably fade away from our, if not our memories, from the news of the day. That's always been the pattern in the past. Park Geun-hye's ratings have come down, have plummeted even from 70s to high 40s now. But 48 or 40% approval rating is still, in the free world, not terrible.
Right.
I think she'll be able to bounce back.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Sung Yung Lee.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sung Yung Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into Israeli spying on the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Stein, who's Newsweek's intelligence columnist. He's a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy. In 2005, he launched Spy Talk as a weekly column at Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007. He's the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And he has an article at Newsweek, Israel Won't Stop Spying on the U.S. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Stein.
Thank you very much.
And the headline for your story, at least the takeaway, was that the Secret Service, a Secret Service officer, was having a moment in Al Gore's bathroom at the vice presidential residence, I assume, and he heard some scraping sounds. Did they find actually an Israeli spy in the air conditioning duct?
The agent was having a moment of solitude in the vice president's bathroom in his hotel in Jerusalem.
Oh, I see.
And heard a noise, looked up at the air duct, and saw someone unscrewing it from the inside. As the head began to emerge, he coughed, and the person withdrew back into the tunnel and was gone. So that was long ago. That was 16 years ago, and people have had a lot of fun commenting on that particular episode. But the main thrust of my two pieces that I wrote this week for Newsweek is that Israeli espionage in the United States is ongoing and pervasive. It has been for a long time.
And it's come to light, though, in these classified briefings on legislation that would lower visa restrictions on Israeli citizens. And
that's right.
That seems to be where there's been some pushback from the intelligence community.
That's right. I didn't go after this subject. It sort of just popped up. Congressional Quarterly, my old employer, did a story about the visa restrictions and the various legislation that's circulating on the Hill to allow Israel to get on the no visa list. And Congressional Quarterly's John Broder learned that intelligence officials have been giving briefings on the Hill opposing any relaxation in the visa restrictions because of ongoing Israeli espionage and the security threat that Israel opposed to American industry and technology, as well as military secrets. And he mentioned that in passing, and I then picked up from there and began to plumb the subject more deeply with my intelligence sources and found out that it was not only true that the U.S. officials had been giving these briefings on the Hill behind closed doors, but that there was a much wider spectrum of activities here, and that U.S. Intelligence, counterintelligence officials were quite angry about it.
But apparently the Israelis did promise after the Pollard was caught, and you know he's become a cause célèbre, particularly in Israel, where his release was, I think, offered up as a sweetener in these recently collapsed Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Did they not promise not to do it anymore, but they've continued to do so?
They did, and this these articles of mine have caused quite a hubbub in Israel, and these and officials are ritually repeating these promises. They said, we promised to stop. Well, first of all, they did not admit that Pollard was their spy for many years after he was convicted. So now they're saying, well, we promised to stop after that. Well, they did promise, and they haven't. There's never been a cessation of Israeli spying in the United States. So it's just a fact of life. And my calling attention to it, some people have said it's like calling about, complaining about gambling in Casablanca.
And again, let me remind the audience that I'm speaking with Jeff Stein, who's Newsweek's intelligence columnist. He's a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy. In 2005, he launched Spy Talk as a weekly column at Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007, and he's the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And he has an article at Newsweek, Israel Won't Stop Spying on the U.S. Well, you know, we had an incident out here in Los Angeles some time back where the FBI did a black bag job on a company called Simco that was run by a former high-level employee. I think he was with Lockheed or one of the big defense contractors. And his partner was a famous movie producer, Arnon Milchan. And it turned out that that was a front for stealing Krytons, which are the high-speed electrical switches that create an implosion on plutonium bombs for nuclear weapons. So it's a pretty bizarre thing that Arnon Milchan was then able to go on and have an incredibly successful career here in Hollywood. I don't think he lives in the States anymore. But what is that? What is the nature of Israeli spying in that regard? That they have fronts like movie producers. It doesn't sound like anything that this.
Well, he was a businessman.
Uh huh.
And what Israel needed to acquire to materials for its nuclear bomb program were to set up front companies that could gather the equipment and the technology independently. And so these companies were set up to disguise what Israeli agents were doing. And Milchin was one of them. And he kind of boasted about it, did he not?
Oh, yeah.
That he had been an Israeli agent for decades. There are agents of all kinds. There are people who steal secrets, and there's other agents who attempt to influence opinion or to direct policy or to spy on U.S. policy and, to policymakers and to get inside information. I was in Israel. I had a wonderful trip to Israel in late January, early February, and I spoke to many high current and former Israeli intelligence military officials. And I had really, realistic talks with them and a great give and take. And what you come away from if you spend time there is if you really understand how beleaguered Israel feels because of its geopolitical position. It's a tiny place. You can drive across the country, well, at least from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv in 45 minutes. It's a tiny place. There are 100,000 Hezbollah rockets in southern Lebanon. The turmoil in Syria right next door. I mean, everything is right next door. And you understand this. You come away from that understanding, whether you approve of it or oppose it, whatever your ultimate feelings are, you understand better the fortress mentality that Israeli officials have. And this reinforces, in my belief, I don't go into that in these pieces I wrote, which were just pure reporting pieces, you really understand how and why Israel would not leave it to someone else's fate for them to understand what's going on in the United States or to acquire American technology that they feel they need. So they steal it. And that's just a reality. And it's a given among U.S. counter-spy officials, counterintelligence officials. I mean, there's no debate about this. This is not a, gee, are they really doing that here? I don't know. Is it really SBS? There's no question about it. I mean, it's just a given. And U.S. counterintelligence officials, at least once they're retired, they will regale you with stories of Israeli espionage here. I mean, there's kind of almost a grudging admiration of it here.
Well, so, in your discussions, though, Jeff Stein, with Israeli intelligence officials, there was a documentary film that was up for the Academy Award recently called The Gatekeepers, in which almost all of the former heads of the both domestic and foreign intelligence were on camera lamenting the political direction of the country clearly showing that there's an enormous divide between the intelligence people and the politicians. And I think just only last week, I think a senior intelligence official came forward in Israel and said that the Iranians were 10 years away from building a bomb, which, of course, is not the narrative that Prime Minister Netanyahu is putting out.
That's right. You can have discussions openly in Israel that you cannot have here. And you certainly can have them privately. The military and intelligence officials I talk to don't put Iran at the top of the list of the mortal threats to Israel. They put the lack of a solution with the Palestinians as number one and number two. Another mortal threat to Israel, Israeli officials who are not religious extremists will tell you, is the ultra-Orthodox. That's a mortal threat to Israel, in the opinion of the senior officials I talk to. And there's great frustration and sadness in Israel among Israeli Jews that the leadership of Israel, in the personified in Netanyahu, cannot or will not come to grips with fundamental problems in Israel. And Iran is not at the top of the list. So we're a little bit off the subject of Israeli.
Sure. Well, let's get,
this is one of the things that, you know, that saddens many Israelis.
Well, back to the intelligence issues and the extent to which Israel's efforts to join the list of favored nations whose citizens are not required to have visas to come to the United States. The intelligence community have been testifying against this. It's under the purview of the Department of Homeland Security. I take it that the main argument coming from the U.S. intelligence community is that adding Israel to the visa waiver program makes it easier for Israeli spies.
Make it easier. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't be rewarded. In any event, the Israelis have not taken step one to go through the bureaucratic hoops that are required to get on that list. Not one. They haven't taken one step. I mean, they're supposed to report, for example, lost and stolen passports regularly to Interpol. They don't do that. They are not well along in converting their passports to e-passports, you know, with a microchip in them for greater security. They haven't even met yet with DHS officials to begin this process. They're trying to do it through a backdoor in Congress, legislatively. So,
and that's to do with their influence over Congress, right? They feel pretty...
Yeah, it's easier.
Yeah.
Because they've got friends there. So, they're so far away. But intelligence officials have been giving these classified briefings to members of the House Foreign Affairs and the House Judiciary Committee on these bills, and they're against them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeff Stein.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Stein, who's Newsweek's intelligence columnist. He's a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy. In 2005, he launched Spy Talk as a weekly column at Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007. He's the author of A Murder in Wartime, The Untold Spy Story That Changed the Course of the Vietnam War. And he has an article at Newsweek, Israel Won't Stop Spying on the U.S. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.